David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Hi, David. What's new?
Hey, Rob. I've got three cool stories for you. We're going to talk about why tree leaves change color in the fall, how an optical illusion is shedding light on the crosstalk between our sense of vision and our sense of touch, and finally, how our early ancestors may not have been the swingers we thought they were.
Well, let's start with how leaves turn red in the fall.
Well, actually, Rob, this story is not about the how, it's about the why. Scientists already know how leaves change color, but they really don't know why tree leaves change color. And there's been a lot of theories about this. One theory says that tree leaves change color to resist sun damage. Maybe the sun is stronger in the fall. But there's been another interesting theory that tree leaves change color to dissuade insects from attacking them. The same way you might see a very colorful butterfly or a colorful frog in the Amazon, a lot of times creatures adopt these very colorful patterns to show that maybe they're toxic or they're poisonous and, you know, hey, don't eat me or don't attack me because you're going to get sick. And some scientists have wondered, are trees doing the same thing? And the cool thing about this study is they try to solve this riddle by using a natural experiment. It turns out that a lot of the apple trees we see in the U.S. and also in Europe aren't very representative of the way apple trees used to be, of their wild cousins. And apple trees actually first originated in Central Asia and countries that are now like Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan.
And they're redder there, or their colors are more vibrant?
In this new study, scientists looked at some of these relatives of our sort of more, you know, quote unquote, domesticated apple trees. And what they found is that if they looked at these trees in Central Asia, 62% of them sported these bright red leaves in the fall versus only about 2.8% of them in Britain and only about maybe 5% of them in the U.S. So these wild trees have much brighter colors. And now, so they said, well, what's different about these wild trees versus the cultivated trees?
So there was something that the domestication did to dampen the colors?
Well, the idea was maybe, yeah, when the trees were domesticated in the U.S. and in Europe, maybe the selection for maybe bigger fruit or more fruit or whatever somehow selected against more bright leaf color.
How do insects respond?
Well, that's the big question. So to sort of show whether this theory about whether this coloration was some sort of warning to insects, the scientists actually put aphids on these two different types of trees. They put aphids, which are sort of a pest of apple trees, on trees with leaves that really didn't change color, so the leaves were mostly green. And they put the aphids on trees which had a lot of these really bright red leaves. And what they found was that come spring, 60% of the aphids in the green trees survived versus only 29% of those in the red trees. So even though the scientists didn't show it specifically, it seems to argue that maybe there is something poisonous about these red leaves or just something undesirable about these leaves that's harmful to insects. So when the trees get, you know, bright red, when the leaves get bright red in the autumn, they're saying to insects, hey, you better stay away.
Or potentially the domestication did something else.
Right. And, you know, that's a real confounding factor here. It may be completely unrelated. Maybe just the fact of selecting for trees that produced bigger fruits caused different colors or caused the lack of colors. And it has absolutely nothing to do with insects at all. So there's potentially one intriguing theory about why leaves change color in the fall, but definitely not the last word on the subject.
Well, let's turn next to the story about crosstalk between visual and sensory experience. What you see is what you feel?
Well, that seems to be what researchers are showing in this study. And Rob, this study has to do with all the senses we have. You know, we talk about our five senses like sight and touch and smell and things like that. And until recently, scientists thought that the brain processed all of these senses separately. So you look at something and only the visual part of your brain lights up, or you touch something and only the part of your brain responsible for, you know, interpreting tactile stimuli lights up. And sort of never the twain shall meet. But in the past few years, there's been some sort of interesting research that suggests that maybe the picture is not that simple. In fact, one interesting study had to do with blind people reading Braille. And researchers, you know, would look at their brain while they read Braille, and you would just expect, you know, people running their finger over a series of raised dots, it's just going to activate the tactile regions of the brain. But in fact, it also activates the visual regions of the brain. So it suggests that, you know, there may be some sort of crosstalk happening, you know, within our brain. Our brain's not just processing these senses separately. It's actually maybe combining them early on at some level.
And this would be for more than just blind people who may be experiencing this as a way of the brain compensating for the lack of sight.
Right. And that was the question. Is this something that just happens in blind people, or does it happen in all people? And what they did with this study was they looked at a really interesting optical illusion called the motion after effect. One example is if you stare at a waterfall for, say, 20 seconds, and then you look at an object next to the waterfall, say, like a tree or a rock, those objects will actually appear to be moving upwards for a brief period of time. And this is an optical illusion. And actually, if you check out the story on the site, there's a test you can take, which has other types of optical illusions, and you stare at patterns, and then you stare at other patterns, and they look totally funky. It's kind of cool. But this is just obviously a visual illusion, and what the researchers wanted to see in this study is, can we combine this visual illusion with a tactile stimulus and see if the two influence each other?
So how would they go about doing this?
Well, they have this device called the Da Vinci, and it is a kind of cool device. It's a centimeter square array of pins. You put your finger basically on the pins, and it taps, you know, patterns onto your hand. You can actually see a video of this in the story as well. And they had subjects stare at these illusions on the computer while Da Vinci tapped patterns in their hand. And so, for example, they would have a subject look at a series of lines that looked like they were falling down the screen while the Da Vinci tapped a pattern on their finger that was just sort of a stationary pattern, which is sort of a tap, 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 all in the same place on their finger. And they also did the opposite experiment, where subjects would stare at something that was static on the screen that didn't really seem to be moving, but Da Vinci would sort of sweep an up or down pattern on their finger. And what they found was when people were staring, say, at a static pattern on the screen, but Da Vinci was sweeping their finger up or down, all of a sudden that pattern on the screen seemed to move in the opposite direction that Da Vinci was sort of tapping their fingers.
Like the optical illusion.
Just like the optical illusion. Yeah. And vice versa, if Da Vinci was tapping a static pattern, but the object on the screen was moving up or down, people would say that they felt like Da Vinci was brushing their finger up or down. So it's really some of this first concrete evidence to show that there really is this crosstalk between how our brains interpret what we see, but also what we feel. And these senses can really get intermingled in our brains as we're trying to, you know, interpret them.
I imagine there'll be lots of scientists now trying to figure out if there's other types of crosstalk. But for this particular crosstalk, are there any applications?
Well, you know, when we talk about the brain, we all often worry about injuries like, you know, stroke or other types of brain injuries. And these injuries can sometimes impair the senses. So, you know, it's a long way off. But, you know, researchers, you know, hope with a study like this, if they learn more about how the senses are working in the brain, then they can learn more about how to treat disorders where these senses are impaired.
Okay, finally, our ancestors were no swingers. Swingers usually refers to sort of a particular type of sexual appetite. Here, I'm guessing you're talking about tree swinging, however.
Right. That was a bit of a tease there. We are talking about tree swinging. And here's how the story goes. You know, 5 to 7 million years ago, the ancestors of chimpanzees and humans split off. Humans sort of took to the ground and chimps stayed in the trees. And the question has been, you know, as soon as our ancestors, you know, took to the ground, did we stay on the ground? Were we still sort of spending half our time on the ground, half the time in the trees? Were we still, you know, swinging around like the chimps? And, you know, what were we doing when we first split off? And that's what this study is trying to answer.
So they're looking at fossils to try to make this distinction?
Well, they looked at fossils in the study. They actually also took videos. I mean, one of the first step they did was they actually took videos of a bunch of wild chimpanzees just to see how they scale trees. And one of the interesting observations they made is that when a chimp climbs up a tree, it flexes its ankle about 45 degrees from the normal position. And that's actually a pretty big degree of flex. And what's interesting about that is humans only can flex their ankles about 15 to 20 degrees. If they flex it any more than that, they get injured. So right away, that suggests that because of our anatomy, we're not able to climb trees as well as chimps, which we sort of knew already, but this is sort of, you know, providing some physiological evidence. But, you know, then they went beyond that. As you said, they started looking at fossils, and they looked at these fossils of hominins, which are, you know, this sort of group that includes these ancient human-like creatures that, you know, first branched off from chimps. And they looked at their ankle bones. And what they found was the ankle joints of these ancient hominins much more resembled our ankle joints, you know, the ankle joints of modern humans that they did of chimps, would suggest that even back millions of years ago, we don't seem to have had this sort of ankle flexibility that chimps have, which suggests that our early ancestors probably weren't very good at climbing trees. And because of that, they probably weren't spending a lot of their time up in trees. You know, once they hit the ground, they almost literally hit the ground running. You know, once they were on the ground, they really adapted very quickly to this ground-based lifestyle and, you know, just weren't jumping back in the trees at any opportunity.
So it's really the bones that are the limiters, not the ligaments. I mean, babies are extremely flexible with their joints, but the bones is the limitation here.
That seems to be what they focused on in this study, that, you know, what is sort of the limiting factor to being a good tree climber? And it seems to be really this ankle joint and how flexible it is.
People still climb trees all the time. Maybe not as good as chimps, but still, we could certainly go up them.
Right. And that's one criticism that's been leveled at the study. You know, just because we're not built for climbing trees, we do climb trees and we can climb trees. So some researchers have suggested, well, maybe, you know, a long time ago, millions of years ago, maybe we weren't very good at climbing trees, but maybe we still did, especially, you know, it was a good way to escape predators. And so even though maybe we weren't spending a lot of time in trees, we were still probably spending some time in them, especially as a form of self-defense or to get apples.
Yeah. So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about an ancient ecosystem found under the Antarctic ice, and also more insights into those mysterious hobbit-like creatures that were found in Indonesia a few years back. And on the policy blog, we're delving into the fate of GM crops, that's genetically modified crops in Europe. There have been some new restrictions placed on them this week that could have a real impact on how and where these crops are grown in Europe. And also, we're really tracking this big economic stimulus that has been set up by President Obama and the U.S. Congress, and the effect that's having on scientists. And apparently, scientists are just flooding these grants databases with applications because they're trying to get a piece of this money. And we're tracking that and what the impact of all of this influx of cash is going to have on U.S. science. So be sure to check out all those stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.